and welcome to Your Mind Matters, NPL's first mental health awareness podcast, where we discuss mental health and all things related. My name is Lana Bolijack, and I'm in the Education and Literacy Department.
And my name is Ms. Sam Habib. I'm the BUL at NPL Program Manager.
And we are your hosts. Today, we have a very special guest. Mr. Aaron Petrie is joining us in the studio to talk about athletics and mental health. He is a performance therapist and a sports psychology coach here in Nashville. So thank you so much, Aaron, for being here with us today.
Hello. Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here with you guys today.
Yeah.
Let's go. I know this is going to be something that I'll be really interested in talking about. So I'm pretty excited.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Well, before we get into the nitty gritty, we have a little icebreaker question that we're going to ask you. So since we're talking about performance specifically from an athletic lens, any sports that come to mind that you enjoy just casually or play or?
Yeah, I wouldn't call it casually. I love tennis. I play tennis. I watch tennis. I listen to tennis. It's my thing I enjoy doing. It's one of the reasons why I decided to switch over into working with athletes. The end game, or one of the end games, is to somehow have that related to my income and to my daily job. If I can somehow have tennis in my day-to-day life, that would be perfect for me.
Yeah, I feel.
You don't want to overdo it, though. Tennis elbows is real.
It's one of the pains of being a tennis player, and the reality of tennis players is they just push through it and they keep hurting themselves.
Mm-hmm. It's crazy. I feel like, you know what's worse than tennis elbow? Tennis wrist. Like, because I feel like your wrist just gets so, like,
twisted. I'm at an age where I have to warm up.
Oh.
I can't not warm up. If I don't warm up, I'm hurting.
Bro, no, I just broke 30. My knees are starting to, like, I don't know what is going on. But this is not okay.
Yeah.
Like, getting lower back problems and stuff.
Oh, yeah. Mm. I've had two knee surgeries, so I understand.
Jeez. Oh, damn.
Yep. Yeah. I had an ACL, and then I had to fix the first surgery because it just wasn't good enough. But now I'm feeling much better, playing at a pretty good level. But it's just, I just started competing again, and getting back in competition shape is real. Mm-hmm. It's tough. It takes a lot.
So yeah, let's get into this. So Aaron, we're just going to start you off. Just tell us about yourself. How did you get into this field? What kind of inspired you?
Mm-hmm.
What do you do? What do you like? You know, we just want to kind of get to know you a little bit.
Yeah. So first off, my licensure. So I'm an LPC MHSP in the state of Tennessee, which is a licensed professional counselor and a mental health service provider. And I'm also an LPC in the state of Texas, licensed professional counselor. So my journey into working with athletes is not so much the traditional one. I first started off in treatment centers, working with alcoholism and addiction, people in recovery, trying to help them stay sober. I myself have been in recovery for like 10 years, going April. So it's just like something I really enjoy doing. I've always loved. And it was there for me when I needed and wanted to do it. And I was just getting ready to finish getting all my hours, and I wanted to go to private practice. And I didn't know what I was going to do in private practice, I didn't know if I wanted to stay in recovery or switch gears. And I've always loved sports. I always loved tennis. Tennis has been a part of my life, and I enjoy it so much. And I love people performing. I love the anxiety. I love the highs, the lows. I love my own challenges, my own difficulties with it, and my own failures with it. And so I was like, I want to work with people who perform. I want to work with people who perform. I want to work on their performance anxiety. I want to work on their anxiety. I just want to work on them as a whole. And so, when I switched over to private practice, I started working on with just performers. So entertainers, students, athletes, business professionals, and anybody who performs. And let's be honest, we all perform. We all are doing a performance. And so, a good proportion of my caseload is athletes.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, concerning athletes, we kind of did a little bit of research on you. A little bit of cyber stalking, sorry.
Mm-hmm. We have a software called Scraper.
It wasn't that deep. We didn't look for your address or your phone number.
We have a PI department in here at the National Public Library.
Perfect.
But I saw on your Psychology Today page that you had mentioned that you utilize cognitive behavioral therapy.
Mm-hmm.
and also psychodynamic therapy. Mm-hmm. And that was just something that I didn't want to Google and I wanted to ask you in person. So could you elaborate on what that is exactly?
Yeah. So psychodynamic therapy is what you consider like classic traditional therapy. Mm-hmm. Things you see in movies where you come in and we kind of dig around to find the cause or the root of the problem. And so when I went to school and I was learning about psychodynamic therapy, what they always told us was, the problem the client comes in with isn't the problem, you know. So an example is if a client comes in and they're having trust issues with their partner, and we would look at, okay, what are some relationships in the past that you've had that you have had difficulty having trust? What did your parents' trust look like in their relationship growing up? And so psychodynamic therapy is looking at the history, the childhood, family of origin, familial relationships, and how it impacts you today. Then CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, that is something that a lot of people use now. And it's just what I like to see it as, just like reframing. So if we are thinking a negative thought, how can we reframe it in the mm-hmm. the positive, or to not not be as evident or high or distracting? And so, yeah, CBT therapy is more simpler and more in the present, and psychodynamic mm-hmm. therapy is more going to the past.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. Awesome. So that simplifies a lot. In my head, I was like, is he like dangling a...
No, that's hypnotherapy. Yeah. If I could be a hypnotherapist, that would be pretty cool.
That's what I was trying. I was like, I know it's not that, but I feel like that's what it is. Maybe I'm not.
That, I know there's like science behind it, but that kind of therapy just freaks me out. Like, I don't... Yeah,
I'm
kind of
curious about it.
Get hypnotized.
I want to know who I was in a past life. Maybe that'll help me figure out what is going on with me today.
There is a place in Donaldson, actually, where they do the biofeedback and neurofeedback therapy, where they hook up the magnets to your head.
Yeah, like, yeah.
I'm like, man, that is like kind of, it sounds like a Marvel movie. Like, that sounds like you're going to a therapist in like Spider-Man or something. Yeah. Like, it sounds like something is like not right if somebody's hooking up two magnets to your brain and blasting vibes into you. You know what I mean?
Yeah, there's somebody in town who does that. I used to work next to them. I think her name was Pamela Drury. Yeah. She does that, and it's, yeah, it's really cool how they sit there for like 45 minutes or an hour, and they learn what's going on with them and how to neurologically what's going on. And yeah, it's pretty powerful if you know what you're doing.
Yeah, I've done a little bit of CBT. And I guess psychodynamic is like the therapist that I go to does psychodynamic therapy.
Obviously. Most therapists, yeah. Yeah, yeah. They
it's like nothing is what it seems, yeah. Man. You hit that like right on the head with that one. Yeah. I'll be like talking about something and she's like, is this because like your mom is, and I'm like, I never thought that this was ever about my mom, but here we are.
Yep.
And should we like address perfectionism and just get this? Perfectionism.
Yeah, no, perfectionism in sports is a big deal. You know, they like to see it sometimes as a double-edged sword. So, like, these athletes are trying to perfect their craft. They're trying to be as good as they can, and they're trying to go to the highest level. And so a lot of people see it as a positive, right? Mm-hmm. No, look at me. I'm going to be as good as I can be. I'm going to not take anything less than perfect, and I'm going to keep shooting for it. And I think sometimes it also gets to, well, wanting perfect means it's not good enough, right? Like, this shot, well, it's not perfect, it's not good enough. This routine, it's not perfect, it's not good enough. This, and then that sometimes leads to, like, if this shot isn't perfect, it's not good enough, I'm not good enough. You know, I can't do it. I'm not capable of being on the team, being on the field with these other players that are, sometimes we see as perfect. Like, oh, that, look at that person, they're doing so good. They're perfect, right? And then, when reality is in their head, they're like, I'm just trying, like, I'm just getting by. So I think when it comes to perfectionism and working with people, it's like trying to work on more realistic goals. Like, let's right size goals. Let's make them smaller, right? For this podcast, you know, my goal was to prepare as best as I can. And that's it. Like, whatever else happens, that happens. But like, as long as I knew I was prepared as best as I could, check. I did good enough today. I did good enough for myself. And so just trying to have those and recognizing like progress over perfection. Like, hey, did you build up like 0.5 today, 1% today, 2% today? So I think working on with perfectionism in sports is just, again, trying to right size goals and change the mindset to growth rather than trying to be perfect.
And it busts out of sports too. I think it's like just people like it just in general with the idea of like perfectionism, I think it's like so ingrained in the way that we are living, like mm-hmm. here
in society,
in society mm-hmm. just in general. Yeah. Like there's a lot of like, okay, like, you know, I can always do better. I can always be better. Mm-hmm. So for people that are like out there that are, cause I know we have like, we have athletes that are listening and we also have like, you know, just like your regular, you know, non-flex muscle people, you know what I mean? Just like doing perfectionist type of stuff out there. What is like a tidbit that you, where would you start if they've never been to therapy, if they've never, you know, done anything and they're like super stressed out because they're trying, they got the OCD, they got the perfectionism. Where do you start with that? Like, how do you even start to break that down within yourself?
Yeah, I would just say if you can recognize that it's perfectionism, right? I think sometimes we don't see it as it's perfectionism. We see it as like, no, this is my skill that makes me better than other people because when I am shooting for perfect, look how good in the thing I get, right? And but then we don't look, we see the product, but then we're not looking at the stress it's caused us outside of the product, right? I think first off, recognizing that perfectionism is happening with the person and that it's causing them stress, anxiety, worry, depression, low feelings of self-worth unless the product is perfect, right? Mm-hmm. Once they recognize that, I think, again, going back to, like, right-sizing goals. Like, let's just make the goal smaller. Like, we don't need to be at 100%. Let's be at 60. Or, like, my this guy who works at Hadley Tennis Center, his name's Rodney, he tells his students, he says, he asks them, they're, like, little kids, 6 years old to 10. He's like, all right, if there's 10 points, how many do you have to win? They all yell, 10, 10. He's like, no, you got to win 6. And it's true, right?
Yeah.
Like, we don't have to be at that level. And so another person who gives a really good example of this is last year's U.S. Open female winner was American Coco Gauff. She did amazing, great. The final was spectacular against Sabalenka. She goes on and tells people throughout the week that she won that with her B game. So Brad Gilbert was telling her the entire time, like her coach, Brad Gilbert was like, hey, you don't have to have your A game. And so she before was like, if it's not the A game, it's not good enough. If I'm not playing perfect, I'm not good enough. And she'd lose. And so during the 2 weeks of the US Open, she was like, my B game is good enough. Mm-hmm. And so she was saying it like, I'm winning with my B game, which I don't know how other players felt about that. But she was able to perform at that level. So again, trying to right size goals, trying to understand that like, 80% is good. For a lot of us, 80% is better than the average people, right? Because we're doing things that we love and we enjoy and we practice. And so I think those are the things I would say. If they're not trying to go to therapy and they want to start off, those are the things I would be suggesting.
Do you think like the algorithm of like, there's like certain podcasts out there that are like super popular right now or like certain like trends that are super popular where they're like the optimal levels of your blood work and stuff like, do you think that consuming all of that kind of like media has an effect on athletes and people that are like trying to exercise and like taking in all of that media where they're like, I have to be running at this perfect pace for this amount of time, or I have to like build up, you know, this amount of, you know, optimal diet where you're measuring, you're like calorie counting and you're measuring how much protein you're like taking in and like all that stuff. Is that healthy or does that get at a point where it's like, what are we even doing here? Like,
yeah, no, I think information is in itself, like it's a good thing, but like over consuming it does become bad. And yeah, like we're always hearing like, I think when we're looking at social media, we should definitely understand like they're trying to catch our attention in the first 10 seconds, what you're doing is wrong. I've heard that so many times and I'm like, am I doing that wrong? Am I doing that wrong? Like I've been doing it for, it feels good though. Like, and so understanding that, yeah, they're trying to catch our attention. They're trying to have that moment of attention to sell us something. And yeah, I think consuming of optimizing, being the best, elite athlete, elite mindset. If you're not doing this, it's not enough. It's not good enough. And or we have the people who are telling us their lives and how good they are, which I mean, that's great. I love how people are succeeding and we're able to see them succeed and I want them to succeed, but it does become much. And even before this, 2 days ago, I was like, I'm getting off of my phone. Like I want to have, I want to be more present. I want to be more, less judgy of myself. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter what I'm watching on the phone. If I'm scrolling and watching little short videos, I'll start being judgy of myself. And so, I took a little break off before this to make sure I was less self-conscious.
Dude, my grandmother reminded me. Also a couple days ago, I was like, man, I got to get off of my phone, because I was like getting out, checking Instagram. And she was like telling me the famous like proverb comparison is the thief of joy. Mm-hmm. And I was like, that is literally social media. That's like what Instagram is. I'm just like out here looking at people's lives and like basically trying to compare myself to it. And I am not happy because I'm just like checking this every morning. I'm seeing like genocide and, you know, so I don't know. But anyways,
I was going to add to that too, just the idea of like everyone has an opinion now. Everyone is like a microwave therapist. I find I specifically like struggle with like religion because, well, my dad's a pastor. And so like my whole life I've been like raised this certain way. And then like when you get into like preacher TikTok, you know, everyone's a philosopher, everyone's an evangelist, everybody knows the answer to everything, but like the answers are always deviating, the line is always moving. And I was getting really overwhelmed because I'm like, well, this pastor says that this is okay, but this pastor says it's not, and this pastor says I'm going to hell, and this pastor says that I'm perfectly fine the way that I am. And it's like those same kind of ideas, like all of these different voices are like contributing to who you are, who you should be, what you should be doing. And it's like sometimes you just need to quiet the noise, you know, turn it all off, which is very difficult, but needs to happen for sure. So kudos to you.
Oh, absolutely. I think a little detoxify of the phone, digital detox is super important. And when I was a teacher, I would tell my students, hey, before you take if you have a test coming up the night before, just don't be on your phone. Because, you know, tests aren't as exciting as your phone. And so I was trying to instill it in the kids at a young age, and I still would instill that in athletes, like, or anybody who's going to do something that's stressful or going to put them to the test, stay off your phone for a day.
You know? So I'm not trying to be a perfectionist here, but so how long do you think you need to be off your phone? Or what does that do? Like a detox from your phone, a detox from technology. What is like the time frame that you need to actually start seeing like benefits and results? If you've been on your phone since you're like, you know, 6 years old or something, or, you know, for your whole life, you're like basically looking at this thing every day. Like, I mean, the amount of times that my thumb is like touching the screen of my phone is like insane. Like, I don't even know how many times I'm touching my phone. So I'm like, how long do I need to actually detox?
Yeah, that's a question with more, that's for someone who's more like knowledgeable on that. But I would say starting off small. Like, let's have a small goal, and let's just say like maybe a day of the week, you're not on your phone, and just like that one day, not be on your phone, or like say, okay, this one day I'm not going to be on social media, but I'll be on my phone. Right. And then just work your way off into that. And I think starting off one day a week is fine, you know, work your way up to 2 days. Mm-hmm. And then you'll see some progress, and then you'll be like, you know what? I don't really like being on my phone when I wake up now. I don't like being on my phone when I go to sleep. Or what we all do is like when we're eating, right? Some of us don't even have a mindful meal. We're just like, I know I don't. I'm watching TV. I'm scrolling. I'm doing whatever. And so, you know, even finding that space when we're eating, which is so nice, right? You're just enjoying your meal, being there. It's like 5 minutes.
Yeah, I'm seeing people on their phone driving. Yeah. Like they'll be they will literally be driving and just be like, and I'm like, this is absolute.
This is why you're getting into a car. So just to get us kind of a little bit back on track, I'd like to get into misconceptions about mental health in the sports arena. And, you know, from your opinion and also from your expertise, like, why do you think that therapy specifically is so important for athletes, for performers on these kind of very large, intense stages?
Yeah. So, I mean, we can start off with the misconceptions. And I think some of the biggest misconceptions, or one of the biggest ones I see, is like these people are performing at such high levels. They've put themselves through so much and they've gotten so good, and they've struggled and they've used their grit and they've trained, and they're expected to just push through it, right? They're expected to just perform. They're expected to, well, if you'd worked that hard to get there, you should be able to push through it and work hard again. And a couple of examples that I can think of off the top is like Simone Biles a few years ago had the yips, I believe, and she needed to take a break. And there were so many people that were so upset. They're like, what are you doing? This is for your country. Get up there, perform, do it, come on. And so that was tough, right? And like, that's that misconception of like, this is a person who's reached the upper echelon of the sport, like, and it's specifically her, like the upper echelon, and like she should be able to handle all this and do it. And then the other example I can think of is like Naomi Osaka.
I was thinking that too. Yeah. Mm.
Yeah. Love her. I love her. She's kind of making a comeback. She just won her first match in Indian Wells, if anyone's wondering. So it was great. But a few years ago at the French Open, she needed to take a break. So it was just becoming too much for her for these press conferences. And then everyone was like, what are you doing? You should be able to handle this. Pressure is a privilege and all these things. Mm. And so she ended up having to say, you know what, I'm out. She just like withdrew from the tournament. So I think that's a big misconception that we as people can have on athletes, especially at that high level and even at lower levels, you know, they see this, right? Like college, high school, middle school. And
yeah,
they see that we're putting so much pressure on them. They want to be at that level. And then they're like, well, if I got to push myself. I don't need to ask for help. I can just push harder and push harder and push harder. And sometimes pushing harder isn't the answer. Sometimes it's taking a break.
Yeah.
Figuring out what's going on, talking to somebody. And then like, yeah, in competition, if you're pushing, that's fine. But if you're pushing yourself mentally, emotionally, and spiritually off the field or off the court, then that's something we got to address, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like taking care of that. And I think now therapy is super important for everybody. I'll say that right now. It's always awkward when someone comes up to me and is like, do you think I need therapy? I'm like,
probably.
What do you want me to say? But yeah, I tell everybody, my answer is I think everybody needs therapy. And I think it's something for all of us that should be done as routinely as like going to the dentist, right? We all go to the dentist for our teeth. Like, it's like, think of it as hygiene for yourself, your personality, your emotional well-being. And for athletes, they have all these pressure. Right? They have the pressure to perform, pressure to be at the highest level, pressure from themselves, pressure from their family, friends, teammates, coaches. That's a lot. That's a lot of pressure at any level. And I think having someone to talk to work that out and to be able to share what's going on, even if it's just like an open space, right? Mm-hmm. Open-minded space. And I think athletes deal with depression, anxiety, performance anxiety, stress, burnout, identity issues. And so all these things are like, we all deal with them, but the athlete deals with them in a certain type of way that we're not so much used to. And I think therapy can really help them out when they're trying to perform.
Do you think like, because I know like athletes and performers, there's a lot of objectification that happens. Like we just don't see these people as human beings anymore. Yeah. We see them as kind of like, they're just doing this thing for our entertainment or for, you know, whatever. So, like, turning that person into, like, a literal object, a cog in a literal, like, machine kind of mentality, I mean, I'm sure that has, like, a profound effect on, like, self-esteem and confidence, too. And you're just turned into, like, a number. Or you're turned into, like, a, you know, can you get this done? Can you, like, make this? Can you get this, like, perfect score or whatever? Like, your humanity is almost, like, stripped away from you. And it's, like, devastating, I feel like. Maybe that's where it starts. I don't know. Like maybe you become like an athlete or you become a performer or even somebody working at like, you know, I forgot what you said the guy does, a day trader or whatever. And you get into these like positions where the humanity is like almost taken out of it now. And you're like have to meet these like certain deadlines and quotas and like numbers and stuff. And like, is that where it starts or does it start earlier than that? What is the personality of a performer or an athlete or a high achiever? Do they have a specific like way about them that you can like maybe spot, or is it just completely different personalities that come in?
No, I think it's different personalities, but I think some of them will be like that hype. I want this. I want to achieve this. I want to meet these goals and meet these standards and try to be the best they can and push themselves. And I think it starts that way, right? And then when you get to like the upper echelon of professional sports, we objectify people. We do, and especially because social media has so much anonymity of it. We don't think when we post something, it's a real person. I don't. I'm like, there's no way this person's going to view this comment. And they view so many. And one of them I see a lot is Gael Monfils in tennis. He gets a lot of terrible comments just because of, you know, he's a person of color in tennis. Mm-hmm. And it's very difficult mentally to deal with that all the time. Like he's been getting it since the beginning of his career. And, you know, 30, 40 years ago, it was just a newspaper that would hurt them, right? Now it's like you or me or anybody can just like say something and now they can read that. And so I think this personality is sometimes just who they are. And then the objectification definitely comes from, yeah, just where we're at right now. We have so much. And then, yeah, the social media just does that to us a lot.
For sure. I was going to add too, I don't know if you guys have seen, I haven't seen it yet. I really want to go see it. But the Iron Claw about the Von Erich brothers. They were like a wrestling family. And every single one of them, except for one, committed suicide of some, or is believed to have committed suicide. And I had read a little bit about them before, like, looking at the movie, because I just kind of was curious about, like, what kind of, like, what brings about a whole, like, a whole generation of brothers that are all doing the same thing and their fate is so devastating. And there was this like pressure from specifically from their dad, because their dad was a wrestler and he wanted them to all be really great wrestlers. And so he put a lot of pressure on them, and they were training since they were young. And, you know, a couple of them, like, they didn't really want to wrestle, but that was their dad's dream for them. So they just kind of took the dream and made it their own. But it didn't work out the way that they wanted to, or they had these really intense injuries that led to them not being able to perform well. And so each of them, one by one, had these like moments where they just were like, I cannot live up to this greatness that my dad has set before me. And their response to that was just to no longer be here. And it's heartbreaking to think that something that I think a lot of people consider so trivial can be something that's so like weighty for someone else. Like, it's their entire world since they were young. That's all they've done. And now they can't do it anymore. Who am I? What am I? What's my purpose? What do I do? And I can no longer do the thing that I'm like, I was taught this is all I'm supposed to do, you know? And I, it's just, I don't know. It just makes my heart ache a little bit. But it's interesting to think about, for sure.
No, absolutely. I haven't seen The Iron Claw. It looks really good, though.
It does look good.
I really want to see it. But you hit a point that, you know, identity issues are really difficult for athletes. You know, if they've identified as a basketball player, a baseball player, or a wrestler, and then they lose that, well, who am I? Like, what worth do I have? The only worth I ever got was from playing, doing this sport, and doing this this activity. And I used to get feedback from the crowd and the people. My father could give me feedback, right? And without that, like, what? Who am I? What value do I even have? And so, I've worked with athletes and trying to figure out, like, okay, let's find some value in yourself, value outside. Talking to people about it is a big thing. I think support is huge. Therapy cannot be, I think therapy alone without support is not as helpful. I don't think it'll work. I think you need therapy and support. That's just my belief in it. And so, identity issues are huge with athletes. And even if they're still in their sport, again, what if they have a bad game and they put all their value in just as them, as a wrestler, a baseball player? And, you know, they're more than just that. And I tell my clients, you're more than just your result. You know, you're not your result. That's just one thing, and you're more than that. And so now you brought up a good point with that movie.
With that, like, loss of identity, is it so like, what is self-esteem? Like, is that through doing esteemable acts or doing something, or is it something that comes from within?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I like you saying that, esteemable acts. I do believe in esteemable acts. I think that's great, right? Like, you want to see yourself do things that are positive and helpful and that build yourself up. So I kind of see it as even like confidence, right? Confidence in yourself. And you got to build confidence by doing things. I'm going to reference tennis the entire time. But Alexander Zverev, like, the other day, and I think in the Netflix documentary, was like, the only way to build confidence is to win games. You know, he had an injury, a horrific injury last year or 2 years now. And he was trying to come back and play well. And the only way to win confidence is to win games. And I think that, like, positive experiences build confidence. And esteemable acts, also self-talk, right? Because we can do really good. I can crush this podcast, right? Or y'all can crush this podcast and then leave it and going like, well, it wasn't good enough. Or maybe I could have done better. Or I didn't sound great, right? And so like, I got to be able to tell myself like, no, I did well. That was fun. I prepared for it. I got a laugh or two, right? You know, one of those mm-hmm. things, and just like talking to self and like building self up. And so I think it's external because the world around us is what we live in, and internal, and that's the world we create for ourselves. Like mm-hmm. We've seen plenty of people who are doing awesome, kind, loving things and who just feel terrible and do they take their lives away, right? Like because they feel so badly inside. And so both of them need to be worked on to be able to take good self-esteem. You need to work on the internal and the external.
Is it more of like security and insecurity kind of situation? Like if you have like the, if you're in a social setting and you're just kind of like insecure about being in that space, or you feel like unwelcome or something, can you still have like high or like, you know, healthy self-esteem if you are in a place that is making you feel bad? Like if you're in an environment that is like constantly doing these microaggressions to you, mm. or you're like, you're not good enough. You have to be like this competitive environment. Can you, like, how hard is it to have healthy self-esteem in that environment?
Well, that's difficult, right? That is a difficult thing to do. Like just constantly stay in an environment where it's bringing you down. And I'll go back to the support, right? Because unless it's like your living environment where that's another issue. But if it's like a sport and where the coach is this way and the players are this way, and so, but you can go home and you can receive that support, that love, that kindness, and then build yourself up. I think you can handle it. I also think though, like there's a limit. Like, well, if I keep going to the same space and I keep getting beat down and after a certain point, I need to do something. Like I'm still putting myself in this situation. And so, I think there is a way to improve. There's a way to handle it, but it can also just be too much. And changing the situation or environment is a good idea as well.
Piggybacking off of that, for an athlete specifically, if the environment of performing in your sport is the environment that is potentially like the issue, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, how do you as the therapist kind of, or do you suggest like taking a break from the sport? Is that something that you think is necessary sometimes? And I'm sure that gets a lot of pushback if it is. So does that make sense? Like,
I think I can hear that. Yeah. I think that's a case by case situation, right? So if an athlete is in a an environment where it's unhealthy, destructive, hurtful, and I think, yeah, I don't think maybe taking a break is necessary, but maybe like finding a different team or a different outlet or a different space. Mm-hmm. But also I think, you know, finding some support outside of the realm. I think family, friends, people to talk to, right? Start off there. I think with starting off with family and friends is the first thing anybody should really start off with doing, and asking them and talking to them and opening up. And because once you find out, like if you talk to some people, you sometimes find out you're not alone, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, a friend can be like, dude, I felt the same way. That coach sucks. Like, you know? And so like, and then your parents, right? They're like, man, I had the same issue. Right? And hopefully we have supportive family and supportive friends starting off there. And if they are not able to, you know, emotionally handle what's going on, then yeah, seeking a therapist, some help, outside help, some professional help. And helping reframe some of it, build the esteem, setting boundaries. Because, yeah, we sometimes think, oh, you're my coach. You can talk to me however you want. And it's like, well, maybe not, right? Maybe you can be helpful and you can positively critique me. But if you say everything I do sucks and I'll never be anywhere because if I keep throwing like this, well, then that's not going to help anybody. Mm. I've had a client before who told me their coach was talking to them like that. And yeah, that's not going to help. It's not going to get anybody anywhere. Traumatize them for a while. So, I think case by case, if it gets to the point where they get major depressive disorder, there's who have suicide ideations, you know, I think maybe, yeah, let's have a talk about taking a break.
What are some warning signs before you get to like major depressive disorder or suicidal ideation? Mm-hmm. What is like some red flags to look out for low self-esteem? Like somebody that has low self-esteem, how do they know that they have low self-esteem?
Yeah, I mean, the first one that I see a lot is isolation. You know, when someone's not wanting to, if they were spending a lot of time after the team, after the game with their friends, and they stop doing that, right? They're like, oh, I don't want to spend, I want to go home. I want to be myself. I want to just be here. They start feeling worse about themselves. And the thing that I do notice with major depressive disorder, specifically major depressive disorder, is like lack of hygiene. Mm. I don't even take care of myself anymore. I'm not going to shave. I'm not going to brush my teeth. I'm not going to clean my room. I'm not going to. That's a big sign. Like that's one of the signs where when I ask a client that, I put a little circle. I'm like, okay, like something's going on, right? Like that's one of the ones I see. But I think isolation is huge. When we start seeing someone who used to spend a lot of time with everybody else, or used to go out, or used to talk, or used to be with their family, and they're always starting to isolate. All right, that's something to pay attention to. Whether you're that person or the support of that person. I would say those are the major ones.
What's something you can do if you're the support of that person? Like, and you're seeing, you know, somebody that was, they were hanging out, they were shaving, they were doing all the stuff, but now they're just in their room. They don't want to come out of their room. You know what I mean? Like, they're just kind of like, what's something that you can do?
So on that one, like you always want to take care of yourself if you're the supporter, right? You don't ever want to put yourself to the point of like, going past your own emotional boundaries or your emotional tank, right? If you're emptying your tank to support somebody, I think that's a little too much. And so pay attention to that. And what I would say is just being there, right? Like, hey, you know, asking if they want to talk, asking, just being there for them and trying to just listen, right? Because also if you're on the outside, you don't really know what's going on. And our instinct is always to like, well, if you just did this, if I bet you if you went out and played more, you'll feel better. And it's like, but you don't know. And like, we don't know. And so as a supporter, I'd say, listen, if you're a kid and you're a teenager and your friend's going through this and tell your parent, right? Because it might be too much for you telling your parent. And then maybe that parent, I just read in a Psychology Today magazine where, one of the kids was not doing well, and the kid whose friend it was, the kid who was doing fine, his friend wasn't doing well, he told his parent, and that parent called that other parent. And I was like, yeah, that's great. Because maybe they weren't going to tell their parent. Maybe they weren't going to say anything. So just being there and then finding little ways to support. But always, if you're supporting anybody, take care of yourself first. You don't want to put yourself in the position where you taking care of them has now hurt you, and now you're depressed, or now you're resentful. That's not a place you want to be when you're helping somebody.
I'm curious to know more information just about traumatic brain injuries and how therapists can aid in those. Because we had a former board member we presented on Your Mind Matters to the library board. And one of them, he came to me and he was telling me about how, you know, recently, like I had a fall and I hit my head and went to the doctor and they told me I had a concussion and I, you know, was getting treated. And then like I was having thoughts about like hurting myself and I was really depressed. And I was like, I've never been like this, like my mental health has never been this low before. And he learned that there is a connection between a traumatic brain injury and some mental health issues. So do you have any information to like expound on that side? And maybe if somebody has had or is suspected to have had a TBI, what they should do, or someone who's around them, how they can support?
Yes, no, TBI, traumatic brain injury. I mean, we talk about in sports, it happens when you have a physical hit to the brain or the head, and it causes like a structural damage and neurologically. It changes a lot. And we've have a good amount of research from now athletes, but we've had it a while for our veterans, because when they're at war, they'll have those bombs that are just like sound bombs, or they're force bombs. And so that causes a lot of dramatic brain injury, and they come back, personality changes, depressed, inability to control their mood. They'll get angry very quickly and not know why. Memory loss. I was doing something. What was I doing? I don't know what I was doing. You know, like they had to deal with that. And so when treating someone with a TBI, I would always say, like, let's have a team Like, let's get a team involved, get a scan, see what's going on, right? Like, let's see, like, what's the extent of the damage. And I've had a client before who got a scan that was able to really break down what's going on with him and, like, okay, there was damage here, and this is how it's showing itself, and it was really good. And so a team, like a neuropsychologist, a psychiatrist, a therapist, support at home. These are probably one of the more severe cases, because sometimes the issues aren't as bad, right? But I also think that there is TBI support groups. Those are big, because you feel really alone when you don't know why you just got mad. Mm. Or you don't know why you just walked into the room. Or you don't know why these things are happening to you. And as a therapist, we can sit there and listen and hold space and be open. But if I haven't had a TBI, I can't relate. But if you go into a room of people that have had TBI, maybe they've lived with it a few years longer than you have, right, or something, they can really help out and support that person through it. And no, I think TBI is very serious, like in the sports arena, out of the sports arena, again, the veterans who have come back and dealt with it as well.
How many TBIs is too many TBIs? And then is that even a question to even ask? Is it one is too many, or can you get like three TBIs and that makes it worse? And then what is like the spectrum of TBI? Like, do you need to be concussed? Do you need to black out to have a traumatic brain injury? Or is a light hit in the head just enough for you to get a TBI?
Yeah. No, I would say as soon as you get brain damage or injury, I think that's the cutoff point, right? Like, that's a little too much, right? And I think but it's a great question. But I think that's the point where it's like, we don't want to have any TBI, right? We don't have any concussions. Any damage to the brain is very, it's not great. I think there can, I don't really know the spectrum, but I think there can be, right? You know, some person can just have a mild memory loss, right? Every time they try to remember something in the first, they have their short-term memories kind of gone, long-term memories there. That's it, right? Still the same person. I've had people I've known who've had a TBI, and they're just, they're just easy to fly off the handle. Very easy to get angry, right? Very easy to get angry. And you have some that are, like, the board member, very depressed, suicidal, right? And those, I think that's the spectrum that I've seen and I've been able to notice. And I couldn't give you a number on concussions or hits to the head. I would say, once there's damage, I think that's enough. Like,
keep it at a low number. Try to keep it as low as possible.
Try to keep it at zero.
Try to keep it as low as possible.
Well, we only have like a couple minutes left, so we'll wrap this up soon. But I think it would be great to kind of wrap on any resources or recommendations that you have as a mental health professional for anybody who, not just athletes, but people who are struggling with performance, struggling with self-esteem, maybe have related to any of these topics that we've talked about. Can you think of anything in Nashville that we should plug here that would be helpful for a listener to know?
Give us some free options too, if you can.
If they're available, definitely free.
So off the top, I can think of, you know, just other therapists. And I guess if it was per performance, this isn't a free option, but I think there should be at least an understanding of the distinction. So there is a CMPC, a Certified Mental Performance Consultant, and that's kind of like the master's degrees of a sports psychologist. And what they do is they only focus on performance. So let's say you're an athlete who's emotionally well, you're good. You have a happy life. Everything's going good for you, but you're just having trouble finishing the game, right? That last shot is just not happening. And I think that's where a CMPC, Certified Mental Performance Consultant, helps. And looking for one of those is great. And there's one in town. Her name's Melanie. I blank on her last name. She's really good. I'm going to be going to her for some more information because she knows it very well on the performance side. And I know the emotional side. And that's kind of what I like to do is I want to bring the emotional side and the performance side together when I work with my clients. And sometimes they don't want that. Sometimes they just want, I just want my performance to get better. And I'm like, that's cool. That's not me. Go a different direction.
That's an emotional petri dish right there.
That's what I'm talking about. I guess the other resource I would say that may be helpful if we're talking about athletes and teams is maybe for like coaches, parents, admin, organizations, maybe because we were always like, what can we do for the students? What can we do for the athletes? What can we do for them? It's like, well, maybe like going to your own therapy for a little bit, you know, getting that practice. Like, and maybe you don't have an issue. Maybe you don't have a problem or something to work on, but at least having that experience is helpful, right? Like, oh, well, Johnny, I went to therapy the other day, right? And I got help and this has really helped me. Maybe it can help you. Or you learn the language, right? You learn the language. And then when an athlete comes up to you and is worried and frustrated, you know how to talk to them a little differently, right? You can like speak a little differently. You can maybe share some of the tools that you got. So that's how I would say as a resource. It's always there for coaches, again, teachers, admin. Psychology Today is the only thing I would say. I apologize. I don't have a lot of resources in Nashville that I would say be resources for athletes. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure I can come up with some and then send them to you guys.
Absolutely. And are you comfortable plugging yourself? If people want to get in touch with you or learn more about what you do, maybe, you know, schedule a time, are you comfortable with sharing?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No, my name's Aaron Petrie. You can find me on Psychology Today. My website is advancedmentalperformance.com. I got a Facebook as well, Aaron Petrie or advancedmentalperformance.com or Advanced Mental Performance on Facebook. And if you want to have a consult, just message me on any one of those. We can schedule a time, talk to see if we're a good fit. I'd love to work with more people and work with performers as well. And anyone dealing with performance anxiety, stress, burnout. And if I can't help you, just I'll do my best to kind of lead you in the right direction. I think that's been one of those things that I've been really passionate about when, as a therapist, if I'm not the right fit, let's see if I can help you find the right fit. Because it really is a daunting task to look for help. It's a daunting task to ask for help. And when you're like, oh, this person isn't a good fit, you're like, I don't want to do it anymore. So my goal would be to help you as much as I can to try to find you the right fit. And so reach out if you need to.
Thank you, Aaron, for being with us today and having a great conversation. Thanks, everybody out there, for listening to this. And remember,
your mind matters.